You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Iowa Sportsman Podcast, the number one source for hunting and fishing information, strategy and tactics, as well as conversations surrounding conservation efforts and other outdoor activities in the great state of Iowa. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and this episode of the Iowa Sportsman Podcast starts right now. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Iowa Sportsman Podcast. Today, we have another returning guest on, and he's no stranger to the podcast at this point. His name is Tom Peplinski, and the last time that he was on here, we talked about shed hunting. Today, we're going to talk about early spring, late season habitat work that you can do on your property that may improve some of the bedding areas or the habitat overall on the places that you hunt. And we talk about one of his properties or two of his properties specifically. And it's just a really great introductory podcast for those looking to improve the habitat on your farm. And it's something that you can do this time of year. So it's relative as well. So that's what today's podcast is about. If you haven't already, go to the iowasportsman.com, right? iowasportsman.com, that's their website, and you can do a lot of things there. The first thing that we want you to do is sign up for the magazine, right? It's an awesome subscription, lots of great content in there, and you can do that on the website. Also on the website is a lot of great written content as well. So not only do they have some really good written content on the magazine, in the magazine, they also have some really good content and articles on the website as well. And that's another place that you can find this podcast. But if you haven't already subscribed to the Iowa Sportsman Podcast, please do so. You can find it on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. You can also leave a review there. That would be very helpful. Just let people know what you think about it and spread the word. Tell your friends about this podcast because we're looking to grow. And this weekend, I know this is a little late, but this weekend is the Iowa Deer Classic. Don't forget to stop by the Iowa Sportsman booth at the Deer Classic. I'm going to be there a little bit throughout the day. I'll be bouncing around on Saturday for sure. So if you see me, stop and say hi. I'd really appreciate it. And man, good thing about the Deer Classic is there's not only do I get to see a lot of people that I haven't seen in a long time, I also love checking out the shed antler contest, and I love checking out the big buck wall. So just an overall good time at the Deer Classic. So stop by the Iowa Sportsman booth. Other than that, man, I think we're good to go with today's podcast with Tom Peplinski. We are joined again by Mr. Tom Peplinski. How you doing, man?
Well, good, Dan. How you been?
I feel like when I used to call my mom a lot, I used to call my mom all the time, and I'm not comparing you to my mom, but like, I used to call my mom all the time and we'd have these weekly chats, and I feel like we talk a lot now.
Yeah, we do. I was actually looking forward to this conversation because our last one was on shed hunting.
Yep.
And if I could just pick your brain for 2 minutes on that, I'd like to before we start this one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I actually wanted to start off with that because number one, it's shed hunting season. Number two, after that last podcast we did about shed hunting, you said that you and your wife have been driving around a lot and looking out, you know, looking at the deer herd in the evenings to see if the antlers have started falling off. So what have those drives with your wife been telling you?
Well, and that's the interesting part. So I am an admitted not a fanatic, like you said you are.
Yeah.
So what really caught my attention is when you said that there's some proof or there's some science behind stress causes deer to drop their antlers, especially in January, February time period. Then we had that major cold event, snow event here in southern Iowa. So I was thinking, okay, they're going to really start dropping. And it was right after we did that last podcast, and we've been watching deer, and we're still, as of this phone conversation right now, seeing probably half the bucks with full racks.
Really?
That's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a lot of bucks shed because I, you know, when I'm glassing a, let's say, a cut cornfield with 30 deer on it, and I can definitely pick out that that's a bigger buck, you know, like at least a three-year-old buck or older. I can just tell by the size of the animal, and it's shed. And it'll be with three other bucks that got full racks yet. So it's, I don't know if that's everywhere, but that's what I've been seeing. And it's been kind of driving me nuts because I was thinking that after our last podcast that they were really going to start dropping. I would say right now it's 50-50, but it almost seemed like it was 50-50 the last time I talked to you. And it's like nothing's been dropping kind of since then. That's kind of what I've been seeing.
Huh.
So it's crazy. I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird because I've heard reports and, you know, just like the rut, right? It comes and goes, right? Sometimes a guy will say, oh man, the rut is on and popping where I'm at right now. And then his neighbor or, you know, a mile down the road say, man, I've had a shitty rut. There's nothing moving and there's nothing going on. And just like for you, I'm sure you said that, you know, there's 50-50. I've heard reports of guys saying, hey, all my deer are still holding. And I've even heard reports of guys saying, I don't have a deer on my property with antlers on their head. So I'm sure it's just pockets, different, you know, different deer shed at different times and are affected different by stress and have different food sources and different bedding habits. And so I'm sure it could just be one of like almost anything, actually.
Yeah, I agree. I agree because I was thinking after that cold event, they were going to start really dropping because what you were telling me completely made sense. And I'm still not saying that that's not true.
Yeah.
But it's almost like the deer that made it through that really cold event and snow event, it's like they kept on hanging on to their antlers. So and I am seeing quite a few half racks. So there's definitely a lot of bucks that are right on that edge where one side had fallen off already and the other, they're still carrying the other half.
Yeah.
But, you know, here we are almost March. It doesn't surprise me at all that there's still a lot of bucks carrying full racks.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this. Did that last podcast, other than driving around, did that last podcast motivate you to get out and do a little shed hunting or do a little walking around your properties?
No, I didn't get out and do any shed hunting because I just assumed wait until they're all dropped. That's kind of, I don't feel like going into my bedding areas or walking back in off of food sources and stuff. And I know that's probably not a big deal in February and March, but I just assumed be a little more efficient and put the miles on when I'm not seeing, you know, full racks and half racks and stuff like that. But I tell you what, after that last podcast, my bride and I have been driving around almost daily, glassing the cut corn and the standing beans and stuff that we know are around. And if we're not driving around, you know, I'm just glassing from my house because from my house, I can look south probably a mile rolling hills. And with the spotting scope, you know, I can see 40, 50, 60 deer a night because I'm covering probably a mile.
Yeah.
So we're doing that every night or driving around every night. And that's a direct result of our last podcast because my curiosity has kind of gotten the best of me here now, what's going on. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Hey, at least it's getting you outside, man. You know what's going to happen is you're going to wait. You're going to go out and you're going to find all these sheds, right? And I probably won't find any. And then I'll blame you for having beginner's luck. And then I'll get mad and I'll get jealous at you, right? And then the next time you hop on the podcast, we'll be like, you son of a gun, right? You found all the sheds and here I am putting on miles and miles and didn't find anything. And
well, it sure does seem like every year when I'm putting in food plots or like getting ready to put in food plots or whatever, I'll actually find just as many then as when I'm actually looking for them.
Yeah.
So
I have a couple buddies who have shed dogs. They've trained their dogs to go, and I guess similar to how you train a dog to go bump pheasants, they're able to sniff out sheds or find sheds and bring them to them. And yeah. I don't know if I like walking and stuff, but they don't really have to try. They just kind of walk out in the woods and their dog brings them all the sheds. They'll find 20, 30 sheds a year just when they're out in the woods with their dogs.
Oh, I'd be all right with me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. If I knew how to train a dog to do that, I'd do it. Yeah.
Me too. But today we're going to be talking about something that's near and dear to your heart. You mentioned that on the last podcast that you over the years you have really fallen in love with working the land and working on the habitat on the farms that you own. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I think I want to start this off really high level and just ask you the simple question, why did you fall in love with working on the habitat on your farms?
I think it's because it extends my season all 12 months. I think that's the number one reason why I do it. I don't do it necessarily because I think the deer need better habitat. I don't do it necessarily because I think if you do it, or if you don't do it, I should say, you can't kill a nice deer. I do it because it's fun to do, and it allows me to be part of the whitetail season basically all 12 months.
Yeah.
Because there's always something to do habitat wise. Even if you're not physically doing it, you can be planning for it. You can be, purchasing your trees through the DNR. There's always something to do once you get into habitat, and there's other benefits for it, but at a very high level, that's why I do it.
Yeah.
Cause it's 12 months. It keeps me in the game 12 months a year.
Gotcha. Okay. How long have you been a property owner?
Well, I've been a property owner in Southern Iowa since 2012. I owned land in Wisconsin for probably, well, I'm guessing now 27 years. I owned land, and I just sold that last year.
Okay.
And then we also had there was a group of guys. We had a really big acreage lease in Western Wisconsin for a number of years. I'm just guessing maybe 13 years.
Okay.
So between that lease and owning land in Southern Iowa, I've been doing property management, habitat, food plot type stuff for probably 20 to 25 years.
Okay. All right.
But
so
on my own farms that I own since 2012.
Okay. Let's keep it hyper-focused at this point on the properties that you have in Iowa. And the reason I say that is that will give us a reference. Now, the question I have for you is, when you purchased those properties, did they already have established locations for food plots? Have they been through any tree stand improvement management, or was it just kind of rough ground?
Yeah. Neither farm had any amount of hunting on it at all, and neither farm had any kind of habitat improvements or established food plots or,
gotcha,
any kind of timber stand improvements or anything.
Okay.
Neither farm had any of that.
Gotcha. Did they already have a local deer herd or a deer population on that farm?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In both farms we're in areas that I had done a lot of homework before I bought the farms. So I kind of knew before I bought them that they were in very, what I would consider, low hunting pressure areas where I wouldn't have to really, I don't want to say work real hard, but my chances of getting 2 and 3 year old deer into the 4 and 5 year old age class, which is what I wanted to do, not that everybody has to do that.
Yeah.
Would probably be a little easier than, say, an area that just got really high hunting pressure.
Yeah, yeah. So how far are your properties from your house?
Well, one property I live on,
yep,
and that's,
okay,
that's an 80-acre piece, or an 80-acre piece, and it's really only 40 acres because the other half is row crop, tillable.
Gotcha.
surrounded by roads. And then the other piece is probably, I want to say 18 miles, something like that, from where I live. And that's 120 acres. And that's probably a little bit better deer hunting. That's probably a little easier to hunt. But obviously the 40 right next to my house here is right next to my house. So access for me is a little easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So when you narrowed down the farms, you ended up buying them. I have a feeling that you were already thinking about what you were going to do from a habitat and management, land management, to be the first thing that you wanted to do on that. I mean, cause it sounds to me like, you were already a whitetail nut back then. And just like me, like I'm thinking about buying some property at some point, and I already have ideas in my head of what I would want to do, and I'm not even a landowner yet. So what were some of the first things that you either researched or actually went and did on your property from a management or habitat perspective?
Well, both farms, when I bought them, had access from multiple areas, north, south, east, and actually west. My 120-acre farm, I can get to any of the 120 acres from any direction. In my 40 by the house here, I can get really from any direction besides the west. So to me, that was very important, was access to the property with different wind directions and stuff like that. And then both of these properties, it's not like I looked at that 120 acres, liked it, and bought it. That was probably the 30 or 40th farm that I looked at, that when I said, okay, this meets my criteria, everything I want. And I literally bought it like the next day. I put an offer in and got it because I wanted it that bad. But that was only after 20 or 30 times of walking different farms. And then on this 80 that I bought, it was the same thing. It's probably a dozen farms. I bought the 80 second, probably, 4 years later. So the first thing I want to say is, if you're looking to buy a farm, I guess that's a whole nother podcast, but
yeah,
there's a whole bunch of things that I looked at before I would even consider buying a farm and spending that kind of money just to hunt deer. But then once I owned the farms, because they already met all my criteria, which a lot of the stuff was, I wanted to make sure that there was areas on the farm that I could convert into bedding habitat. Not that it necessarily had to be bedding habitat already, but the potential had to be there that either through plantings or through some hinge cutting or clear cutting or what have you, that I could create bedding where I wanted it. And that's actually the first thing I did on my 120 acre farm that I bought in 2012. That year, my son and I actually went late muzzleloader hunting. And because it's the first year I had that farm, the hunting was pretty poor. The deer had moved out. The local deer herd had moved out because the habitat was actually very poor on the farm. There weren't any kind of standing crops or food sources in between, no egg that was standing and the habitat being pretty poor. There just weren't that many deer on that farm at all. So we only hunted for 1 or 2 days and then actually just put our guns away. And we started on creating good habitat in the form of buck and doe bedding. So that's gotcha. The very first thing I did.
Was hinge cutting.
It was hinge cutting. It was a lot of, I'm losing it right now, but shagbark hickory.
Yeah.
So the predominant tree species on part of that farm, which is where I wanted to put the bedding, was shagbark hickory. So it was easy to go in there and do a lot of hinge cutting. The bigger trees, I didn't even bother hinging. I just cut them down, and we created like a kind of a bigger area of bedding. And then we also created a bunch of pockets of bedding closer to the food for does, and then farther back off the food, which we were hoping would attract bucks later. Okay. So that was in 2012. First thing I did on that farm.
Okay. How did you identify those locations as far as where on the specific piece you wanted to make those bedding areas and implement that hinge cut?
So for me, it's kind of a process. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make. And if I could just touch on that for a bit,
yeah,
I watched a hunting video I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, and it was by a pretty well-known hunter here in the Midwest from Iowa, and he's a good guy. I'm not trying to say anything wrong, but I fundamentally disagree with a comment he made on the show, and he was saying one of his farms, he was doing some plantings, and another farm he was doing hinge cutting, and he made the comment that all of your farm should have great habitat on it, that you should have no part of your farm that's not at its 100% potential for great habitat. And I 100% disagree with that, because the last thing you want to do is attract deer to bed where you have to walk in and out every day.
Yeah.
Or attract deer to a food source where that's one of your access points. So every time you walk out from an evening hunt, you're bumping all the deer off of that food source. So I think that's the number one mistake. And this is not me saying that I've never made this mistake. This is me learning in the past when we had that lease in Wisconsin. I know we don't want to talk about that, but I learned then that you don't want to put bedding and food sources and transition food plots. And these are all things we can talk about today.
Yeah.
But you don't want to put them just where it's easy or convenient, or boy, this ridge right here is open, so I want to cut all these trees down and do a bunch of hinge cutting in here so the deer bed here. Well, you don't necessarily want them to bed there unless it fits an overall hunting strategy. So to answer your question, what I like to do is I like to start with, you can either start with bedding and then transition type food plots, transition areas to like a main food source, or you can start at the main food source and work your way back. Either way. But you want to plan out and encourage, I guess is the right word, the deer to use this bed to transition area to main, like, destination food source travel pattern each and every day.
Yeah.
So when you plan out your hinge cutting, your timber stand improvement, or where you want these deer to bed, you need to have some foresight to say, if the deer are going to bed here, where can I put a transition area in? Where can I put some apple trees and maybe a small tenth of an acre little green spot with a couple tree stands where it leads them out to the egg, you know, the soybean fields and the alfalfa field? And you should really be thinking about all that before you ever hinge cut a single tree or ever plant a single food plot, because the worst thing you can do is just go in and every little opening on your land put a food plot.
Yeah.
And every tree, every spot that's clear and open, well, we're going to hinge here because we want to create bedding cover. Because you don't really want to do that. You want to make your time and your money and your resources, you want to put that to work for you so that it's fun to hunt these deer.
Right.
And you can actually force them into or encourage them into a pattern that you set up for them.
Yeah. Almost like you're making the travel route between point A and point B, and then you're setting up on that travel route throughout the season.
Yeah, so it's the opposite of public land, right? So when you go on public land, you can't do any of this stuff. So you're forced to say, where are the deer bedding? Why are they bedding there? Where are they exiting their beds? You know, what food sources are they going to, whatever that is, and then trying to figure out, how can I get in here on them? What's my entrance route? What's my wind direction? Where do I hang my stand? When you own a property, you can actually manipulate the surroundings and manipulate the food sources and the bedding areas to get the deer to do exactly what you want them to do. So it makes it easier to hunt.
Yeah.
So that really, excuse me, in the Midwest and down here in southern Iowa, you know, all across the Midwest, you don't really need food plots and great bedding habitat for the deer. The deer don't need it. It's already there. They already have tons of egg. People were killing nice deer and had great hunting way before food plots and hinge cutting and everything got popular. What I use food plots and hinge cutting for, obviously going back to, it keeps me in the game all 12 months and it's fun to do, but it also makes it easier to hunt deer because I don't want to say force them into, because they don't follow the script always, but you can manipulate the surroundings so that you can get the deer to bed where you want them to do, and you can get the deer to follow a certain draw out next to your transition plot, and then right on by you, out to your destination field, and you get down from your stand and walk back to your cabin, and the deer never knew you were there.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Now, when you did implement that hinge cut, you know, and created those bedding areas, did you see a direct result in that, like the next year?
Yeah, so the next year, it definitely got better, because when you open up that canopy, the undergrowth just explodes, and the first thing that'll come up is your stump growth.
Yep.
And then your blackberry briars, prickly ash. The very next year, that stuff is up 2-3, you know, sometimes even 4 feet. But I think really the best bedding habitat that you get from a hinge cut is probably year 2 and 3. And then you're forced to go back maybe in years 5 and 6 and maintain those bedding areas. Cause if you don't, the habitat that you created back in years 1, 2, and 3 is now going to grow past what the deer need as far as woody browse for their daytime snacks in their bedrooms.
Yeah.
But so it's about a, you know, and I'm just giving estimations. It's about a three-year process where you go in and you do some hinge cutting, excuse me. And hinge cutting is so successful because you're creating habitat instantly, because the hinge cut tree will continue to grow. So the tops are in the ground and continue to grow sometimes for 2 or 3 years or even longer after that. Plus the log, the tree itself, the trunk of the tree creates horizontal cover, which is deer like that, because it protects them from seeing other deer and it protects them from human contact. So, you know, instantly when you hinge cut a tree, you're creating pretty good bedding habitat for deer. Yeah. But what they really want in their beds is that horizontal cover. This is my opinion, but they have to have some kind of woody browse in there during the day so they have something to snack on. That's what they need for good bedding habitat. That's why deer a lot of times don't bed in a 40-acre switchgrass field. They might if hunting pressure gets really, really hard, but their preferred bedding is not in a 40-acre switchgrass field because there's no daytime food.
Right. They want something not only that's going to provide safety, but kind of a snack throughout the day so they don't have to travel so far. Right.
Yep, that's what they want.
Okay.
That's what they want. And if you give them what they want, and then obviously you're creating that bedding area, and it's not always just hinge cutting. So you could have open ground. You could have cow pasture. So let's say your farm is cow pasture, and you want to convert some of that pasture ground into bedding habitat. Well, that might be a combination of switchgrass with some conifers. But within that, you have to have food. So then you might be planting some dogwood or some hazelnut, something like that, so that these deer have something to snack on during the day, and then they'll use it. Then they'll bed in it.
Yeah. Okay. So when you did this hinge cut, obviously it worked. Did you see more deer on your property, or did the deer that were already on your property hang out throughout the whole year?
The latter. The area in the neighborhood already had a very good deer population. In fact, I would argue it's too high and I need to shoot more does, just because I don't think a lot of the neighbors do shoot enough does. So the population was there, but what it did is two things. One is it kept them all year by creating better habitat. And the second thing, it made it easier to hunt, because I created this bedding to transition area to destination, or what I call like an exterior food source, something that's away from cover. And then I got these deer to travel a couple hundred yards every single day. It made bow hunting phenomenal on that farm, because the deer are on this pattern. And I don't disrupt the pattern, because I typically don't hunt the bedding area, and I typically don't hunt the destination or exterior food source. And I'm always hunting these little transition areas where I can get in without bumping a single deer. And then the deer generally will feed past me, headed out to that exterior food source, and I can get down from my stand in the evening and then head back out. And the same in the morning. I can catch them on their way back to bed. But yet when I'm getting down from my stand, I'm not in their bedroom where I can have a chance of spooking the deer.
Yeah.
So it kept them there all year. It made them easier to hunt, which is really the reason why I like doing it. But then the third thing is, if you set this pattern up of bed to transition to feed, and you can do it successfully, you can hunt pretty hard all year and not burn out your farm. which is really the, like, a side benefit of, if you do it right, you can hunt 3, 4, 5 days a week all season long, and you're not going to burn your farm out. Whereas if you go in and you put a little bitty, what they call the big, and I've done this before, so I know how it can harm you. The big thing that the seed companies and stuff are always, they're all selling these kill plot seeds. So every little quarter acre opening that you have on your land, you got one of these little kill plots. And I, the biggest mistake I see hunters doing is they'll have like an 80 acre piece or a 40 acre piece, and they'll have a dozen of these kill plots scattered all throughout their farms, and they're going and hunting all of them. And if you just draw on a piece of paper, like an aerial photo with a pencil, like your access route where you're going in and out and then where your scent is going, well, heck, by November 1st, if you're not seeing any deer on your property, that's why. It's because you basically drove out your farm every time when you went and hunted one of these little kill plots.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, with all that extra pressure, it's never good.
No. No, in fact, you'd be better off, to not ever plant a single seed in a food plot or ever hinge cut a tree if, in your mind, you can't plan out where to put the stuff first.
Yeah.
So there, I don't think there's been enough attention in the whitetail information world about where and how, as much, you know, what seed to plant.
Yeah.
And, you know, what kind of seed you got to buy and how you fertilize it. And you got to buy all the equipment to plant the food plots and all that kind of stuff. But you can do a lot of harm. You can really do a lot of negative effects to your hunting success on your farm if you do it wrong. Because you'll just, you know, attract a bunch of deer to all these little food plots or these bedding areas. And then by going into your stand and hunting in that stand and then everything, every day, all these different stands you have, you can actually drive the deer out of your property right when it gets good.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, now that you mention it, I have a couple tree stands on one of the properties that I hunt, which I have not put any management efforts into it because it's permission ground. But because of the access, because of where they bed and where the food source are, you know, where the food source is, I have a couple stands along that that route that, with, you know, given the correct wind, I could hunt those tree stands five, you know, as many times as I wanted to with specific wind directions and probably not get busted ever going in and out of there.
So, those are the best stands.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit more about hinge cutting because it's that time of year, right, where now is the perfect time to start doing that because, you know, there's no leaves, it's not hot, you know, there's no vegetation out in the timber, so you can get a really good idea of what you need to cut down. So how big of an area are you giving to hinge cutting?
So I like to do my hinge cutting in pockets. So what I mean by a pocket is once I find the location where I want deer to bed. So I think that's the first key. The first thing is don't ever fire up a chainsaw until you listen to the first part of this podcast and you figure out, where do I want the deer to bed?
Yep.
So where are they never going to smell me? Where am I not walking by them? You know, if my only access is here, I don't want to have my hinge cutting where my scent is going in when I'm walking in and out. So you have to figure that out first. And then I think instead of going and hinge cutting 5 acres, I like to do pockets of, it depends. Sometimes it can be 3 trees. Sometimes it can be 8 trees, but try and make kind of a brush pile. So if you can imagine taking 5 trees and hinge cutting them so the tops kind of all fall on the same pile.
Right.
See what I'm saying?
Yep.
And then I think doe family groups will bet around that. So you might have a doe and a fawn, and then maybe last year's, you know, like a yearling doe with her 2 fawns and stuff like that. They'll bet around that, you know, what I want to call a brush pile. So an actual yardage, that might be 20 yards by 20 yards. maybe 15 yards by 15 yards, something to that effect. And that's enough bedding habitat for one small doe family group.
Right.
And then they'll have the tops to eat on the first year, the second year, the third year, until the tree actually dies. You'll have horizontal cover for the deer, which they love. And then by opening up the canopy, you're going to have all sorts of broadleaf weeds, blackberry briars, prickly ash. Hopefully you have some like dogwood, some native dogwood, maybe some native honeysuckle, different woody browse that come up. And you're basically done. You can make one of these pockets of bedding habitat in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then all you're required to do is go back, like I said, about every 3 years, give or take, and you might have to cut some of the new regrowth down again. Some of the woody browse might actually start growing up and being 1 or 2 or 3 inches tall. And if there's enough of a canopy, all those weed species that you want for the deer to have their woody browse feed for the day, during the daytime, it's going to start getting choked off again. That maybe it'll last 5, 6, 7 years. It doesn't know, but you have to maintain these bedding areas. But again, to go back in with a chainsaw and zip some of them off is really no big deal. And then if you're doing doe family, if you want like doe bedding, then you want to target areas close to food. So for me, because I'm doing main bedding and then a little transition plot and then an exterior food plot, like a bigger food source, that doe bedding area is going to be relatively close to that transition area. And then your buck bedding, so you might have 1 or 2 pockets next to one transition area, and then 200 yards away, if you have a different main bedding to transition to exterior, you might have another couple pockets, 2, 3, 4 pockets, depending on what your deer herd looks like, next to your transition area. And then if you back off another 200 yards, and you don't have to use a tape measure or anything like that, I'm just using kind of examples. Then if you do some more pockets, and then these I usually spread out a little bit more. I'll drop 3 or 4, 5, 6 trees in a pocket, but then I might go 70, 80 yards away and drop another pocket of trees, and that'll be more for your buck bedding.
Yeah.
To get it back off of food, a couple hundred yards back off of that food source.
So
by doing this, if you do it correctly, the deer are going to want to bed there because they have everything they need for daytime bedding. They have the food, they have cover. Maybe there's a little water hole in there somewhere. So they're going to bed there because you've given them what they want.
Right, right. Now, this is kind of that's kind of unique theory because I don't consume a lot of habitat management type content, but the content that I have, consumed that talks about hinge cutting, or I've seen about hinge cutting, they're doing larger areas of like acres and acres and acres or whole ridges when they're doing their hinge cutting and making huge bedding areas, which I feel like if you're making one giant bedding area and they could bed anywhere in a 5, 6, 7 acre area, you're again limiting yourself to where those deer are going to be bedding, right? You don't know where in that 5 or 6, 7 acres that they're going to be bedding, as opposed to, hey, I know that I did some work right here within a 20 yard by 20 yard area. That's where they're going to bed.
Well, you're 100% right. Number one. Number two is who in the Midwest has 15 acres they can hinge cut. So
yeah.
It's not, most people can't even do that. Number three, if you accept for a minute that I'm correct, that you have to go back every 3 or 4 years and maintain this, I'd rather maintain a 15 yard by 15 yard pocket every 3 years, as opposed to a 15 acre, basically clear cut of hinge trees.
Right.
You know, deer don't need that. Deer don't need 30 acres of prime hinge cut habitat to bed. They don't need it. They don't need anything to bed. They'll bed anywhere. I mean, we know that. Sometimes you see deer bedded 10 yards off the freeway, but what they prefer is to have some horizontal cover, some daytime browse, woody browse, briars, something. They don't need to have an alfalfa field in their bedding area, but they need some kind of daytime browse. And then they want it away where they're not getting pressured.
Right.
And, you know, and in the wintertime, maybe if you can incorporate a ridge that has a south-facing slope or something like that, you know, that's starting to get in a little bit more specifics. But, you know, I guess I'm not a big fan of the 10 acres, the 5 acres, the 10 acres, these huge hinge cuts, because, number one, most people don't have that kind of acreage where they can do that. Number two, they're hard to maintain. And then the third reason, and maybe even the better reason, is you don't create that your desired outcome of knowing exactly where the deer are going to bed. Because now if you've done an entire ridge top and your ridge top is, let's say, 600 yards long, you've just created bedding habitat 600 yards long. And it goes back to my earlier statement of you don't necessarily want the best habitat on your entire farm.
Right.
Not for hunting purposes, because what you're not setting up any kind of movement pattern that you can take advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's multiple exit and entry routes, which just complicate things even more. And okay, cool. So, and specifically to this time of year, and one thing that I've noticed is that this is going to be a multi-part podcast, because habitat, there's so many different things to do at so many different times a year. And so I just want to kind of focus on this March timeframe, this late winter, early spring timeframe. Other than hinge cutting, is there anything else that you're doing this time of year, or anything that you've done this time of year as far as habitat work?
I'm trying to think.
Do you burn?
Probably not. No, I don't burn, just because I'm afraid to.
Yeah.
I mean, guys that burn CRP and stuff, that you can do this time of year. But actually, I'm actually starting to get away from burning my CRP grasses, and I did a lot of work with the NRCS on different methods of disking, like switchgrass and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I'm actually getting away from burning. Although burning is a phenomenal way if you have a weak, you know, let's say you have a stand of switchgrass that you actually want to get thicker. You want more of a monoculture, a thicker switchgrass. Well, then burning is your best. Is your absolute best option. But for me, I've never had where I had to thicken a switchgrass stand. Mine have been really good. So if anything, I actually want to probably knock the switchgrass back just so I can get a little bit of diversity and edge. And that's a whole other topic. But here in Southern Iowa, you have a lot of these draws. So you don't have necessarily 60 acres of timber, a lot of it, like my 120 acre farm has a nice, about a 45 acre block of timber where I do these pocket hinge cuttings. But then there's a lot of draws that come out in the tillable. And if you want to have good bedding habitat for those, or just better habitat in general on these draws, a good thing to do would be to disc that switchgrass, knock that switchgrass back along the edge of those draws, because that'll create some less competition for that grass, so you can get some good woody browse and briars and broadleaf weeds and stuff to grow up, which is better for deer. Because a monoculture of switchgrass for deer provides, you know, decent thermal cover. But like I said before, deer are not going to, typically don't want to, I shouldn't say they're not going to, because they will, but they don't want to bed in a 40-acre piece of switchgrass because there's no food out there during the daytime.
Yeah.
But that's not to say they won't bed on the edge of a 20 acres switchgrass field that has a draw coming up through it, if you can give them some good woody browse and they'll have that nice thermal cover if they're on the edge of that switchgrass.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. So other than hinge cutting, do you do any type of, I guess, logging throughout? I know, you know, logging is a big term, because you think of logging as once every 25, 30 years, I'm going to log my property. Do you do any of that on a large or even a smaller scale?
So that, for me, that's just a question of money.
Yeah.
So when I did this hinge cutting for these shaped by the kick trees like I was telling you about back in 2012. I did the hinge cutting because hinge cutting is probably preferred for habitat because it creates that horizontal cover with that lawn land sideways. Plus, there was no market for shaped bark hickory. If I had that same scenario, the exact same scenario on that 120-acre farm, but instead of being 40 acres of mostly shaped bark hickory, it was, you know, black walnut and red and white oaks and stuff like that, well, then I definitely would have not hinge cut black walnut. I would have sold it on the market and got the money for it. That's not to say that you can't hinge cut a white oak tree and provide great bedding habitat, because you can. You know, a white oak that's hinge cut, I would argue, would provide more cover and nutrition and food for a deer than the acorns that it produces in a year. But at the same time, the business guy of me, or the frugal guy of me, is not going to cut down a tree that's worth several hundred dollars for bedding habitat if I can sell it. So for me, timber harvest and logging is more of a money thing as opposed to a habitat thing. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. So it's more of, hey, I'm going to cash in on this right now while the market is, you know, while the tree market's high, as opposed to, hey, I'm going to, while I'm in there doing management work, I might as well log it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Correct.
However,
correct. I've hinge caught oak trees because it was in an area I wanted to create this pocket of bedding cover, and there wasn't box elder and hickory and, you know, what I would consider more of a junk tree as far as dollars. There wasn't that stuff in there. It was oaks. So I hinge cut some oaks to create a bedding pocket because I didn't see the value in the oak tree for the acorns as much as I saw it laying horizontally on the ground. And some of these hinge cut trees too, like an oak tree, if you're lucky and you hinge it correctly and it falls right for you, and you can maintain enough of that outer bark layer, some of those trees will grow on the ground for 15 years if you're lucky enough.
Yeah.
So I'd argue that creates and gives the deer more nutrition than if you're lucky enough to get a good acorn crop every couple of years or something out of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And from a logging standpoint, let's see, this was like 3 years ago now. I was really mad because I was frustrated. The landowner that I hunt on was like, yeah, we're going to do some timber. We're going to be logging parts of the property. And I'm like, what? During October, late October, early into November. And sure enough, they were in there chopping down trees and stuff throughout most of the archery season. The good news is that through all my complaint, like myself complaining, like, oh, my season's ruined, all this stuff, it has ended up turning into, like, certain parts of where they've done this tree harvest has been absolute awesome habitat in return. Because exactly like what you just said, that sunlight is now being able to get into the forest floor, and it has made it really thick, really nasty. All the treetops are still there. They've taken out, obviously the trunks of what they harvested, but all the treetops are there. The light's down in there. We have all these real young trees popping up, and they're growing really fast. And it has made some absolute beautiful bedding areas on the farm, in some really random places, but still great bedding all the same.
Yeah, so that's a good point actually, because if you're going to bring in a commercial logging company, but they're going to have to be willing, if that's what you want, to log the trees that you want in the areas that you want them to log.
Right.
So that you don't create this great bedding habitat where you don't want it.
Right.
So that's actually a good point, that if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, boy, I really have some nice oak and I really have some walnut or whatever trees that you have value on your land, if you want all the money for it and you want all of it taken out, you know, I can't fault you for that, but just be careful. That's the number one thing I think people do wrong with habitat, whether it's logging or hinge cutting or food plots, is they're spending no time deciding where and all the time deciding what to plant and what kind of tractor should I buy and what kind of seed should I get. And boy, I watched this TV show and they were using this kind of turnip and they were using this canola, and it's always what instead of where. And I think I think the where should be like 95% of it, as opposed to what. That's just my opinion. And it goes right back to your logging thing too. Just be careful from a deer hunting perspective, not from a money perspective, from a deer hunting perspective, be careful if you get a logger in there that takes all 80 acres of your farm or whatever it is, and now you have awesome bedding habitat everywhere and you just made it harder to hunt. Just be careful that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing about this farm is they don't care about hunting. Right. It's your standard Iowa farm. They're there for the ag and they're there for the return on investment. Right. So there was no thought into deer habitat when they went in and logged this place. So they logged all over, you know, random places all over, which overall now made better habitat for deer. But that's the cool thing that I kind of like is I'm in the process of now relearning where all these new bedding areas are and how to hunt, you know, as far as a strategy, learn to hunt the farm all over again in certain parts of it. So although frustrating, it's educational as well, because part of my favorite part of bow hunting is the strategy, right? How am I going to intercept this deer coming through this farm? And it's that chess match we all love, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I can tell you a little story. When I was growing up, when I was like 12 and 13 and 14, there was this hay field at my grandpa's farm. And I'm going off of memory, but this hay field had to be like 40 acres. And I would hunt that hay field almost every night. And I'd see 30 deer every night on this 40 acre hay field. And I never got a single deer in probably 2 or 3 years. And it's because it's too big. I couldn't narrow it down. And I was jumping around from this stand to that trail, and the chances of getting the right trail with the right wind and everything falling together on a 40-acre hayfield was almost impossible. I couldn't do it. And that's the same with bedding cover or food plots. You know, the bigger the stuff is, which is why I like these pockets, going back to that earlier question you had, but I had a different way of explaining it, I guess, now. If you make these little bedding pockets smaller where you can put like a little pin tab on Google Earth and say, that's where that bedding pocket is, that really narrows down where those deer are going back to bed in the morning. Whereas if you did an entire ridge or 40 acres worth, you're right back to my scenario when I was 12 years old. Where are they, how are they going in there? Yeah. Where are they going in? What draw are they taking in? You have no idea. And it probably changes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, I think this is a really good place to stop, because I have a feeling the next conversation starts getting into spring and we start getting into prepping for food plots and planting food plots. And I think that's a whole nother can of worms. So I think this is a good place to stop. So once again, Tom, appreciate you hopping on the podcast, and I'm looking forward to the next conversation.
I am too. I'm looking forward to some warmer weather down here too.
Oh, that's a fact. I still got 8 inches in my front yard.
I don't think we have that, but we're probably not far behind you. But I'd really, I'm getting the itch to get some outside stuff done, and it's the cold and the ice, and we had a half an inch of ice the other day raining, so.
And that brings us to the end of another Iowa Sportsman podcast. Like I said in the intro, please go subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out the Iowa Sportsman Facebook page. Lots of content comes through there. I think they do some contests and stuff off of that page. So make sure you go like the Iowa Sportsman Facebook page. Go and like the Sportsman's Nation Facebook page and Instagram page as well. Lots of good information coming from there. And that brings us to an end of another podcast. I think I don't have too much else to say, except we'll see you next time.